heard a Rav say that the Maaseh of Adam and Chava was a parable. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, this is, you know, it's really very, very unfortunate, you know. There is a very strong branch that's growing an influence of modern Orthodoxy that is talking about things that, you know, Mamash Dapi courses, we're not talking about, you know, can women read Torah, you know, if there's a separate men, you know, those are, you know, halacha, although they paskin wrong in those things too, but those are just mistakes in halacha. But now we're talking about people who say, you know, maybe the Torah wasn't written by Hashem totally. Hashem, like, inspired wise people. I mean, mamish things that are connected the Yid Gimel Ikrei Amunah in a very, very fundamental sense. And they're claiming that they're Orthodox and they're ordaining rabbis. And these rabbis are getting positions in Orthodox synagogues. This is the yeshiva of Chovei Torah you may have heard of. And it's a major, major problem. People who, you know, they say they're not conservative. They demand to be recognized as Orthodox rabbis. So they go around. So a lot of things. Yetzias Mitzrayim is an allegory, and Kriyas Yamsuf is an allegory, and Adam Mechav is an allegory. So I think these things are really kafira. I'm not a person. As you probably know, I'm not a person who throws around that label very lightly. But this already is really crossing some very, very strong boundaries. Now, having said that, let me point out that the notion of something being literal and something being an allegory is not a contradiction, meaning to say, on many, many levels, the Torah gives you literal things that happen, but they are also remuzzing to higher spiritual ideas. The Vilna Gaon, in his commentaries to Megillas Esther, to Yaina, always says that. So on one hand, we have Yaina and the whale. On the other hand, it's a remez to the guf and the neshama. So the notion that things have allegorical meanings is not a problem per se, particularly Adam Mechava, which is the beginning of Bria and the Sheirish of Adam and the notion of Tov and Ra. So it's not the notion that allegorical meanings are problematical. They are absolutely not problematical. But the notion that they are only allegorical and not meant to be literal, I think is a very, very severe concern.
Do we have to say, though, just a question added on to that discussion, like, let's say all the miracles that the Torah talks about, do we have to say that they specifically happen, or could a person say, no, these are, Hashem wants to teach us something, you don't have to say that the miracles happen. I mean, I've heard that a lot of times, that I like the ideas of the Torah, but, you know, I think the miracles are just coming to teach me something.
I think there is a chiluk between, let's say, Midrashim and the Torah itself. Meaning, in Midrashim, there are mahalchim that not all Midrashim, the Maral, for example, not all Midrashim have to be understood absolutely literally. And sometimes Chazal are communicating through a mashal, like Shadim and other things the Rambam writes. The Rambam writes, other people argue, that literally there are not Shadim. So it's shayach, when it comes to Chazal, Mamari Chazal, it's shayach to have such a mahalech, even though that is also controversial, but, you know, it's shayach such a thing. When it comes to the Torah, though, which is the direct word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's very, very difficult to say that if Hashem says something happened, he really didn't mean that it happened. He meant that it was a mashal for something else. So I think that when you're doing it to the Torah itself, which is a word for word from Hashem, I think you run into very dangerous territory. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us, because I've heard many different things. What is the absolute bare minimum of dress sneers for men and for women?
Well, for women, it's a little easier, actually, to answer. Basically, you know, the minimum of tznius is that the shirt must cover the elbow, and the dress must go below the knee. Stockings and socks are not necessarily required by halacha, although mitaminuk. So as long as the dress goes below the knee, that is fine. Not fine, but that's mutter. And that no part of the breast should be exposed, and that includes the part that, you know, where cleavage or whatever, you know, whatever it is. If she's a married woman, her hair has to be covered. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein allows up to two fingers across the width of the forehead not to be covered. So if the tichel or the shekel is up here, that might be okay, you know, etc. I mean, those are what you call minimums. Now, for a man, it's very interesting. For a man, there actually is no halacha of tznius per se, short of the genitals themselves being exposed. So a man can do almost anything, but on the other hand, we have to understand that the isurim, you know, just because something is not usur, doesn't mean it's desirable, and it doesn't mean it's dignified. And we have to remember the general idea that a Jew has to behave in a very dignified, respectful manner, if for no other reason than not to cause chilul Hashem. So their minimums for men are very, very minimal, so to speak. But one should go beyond the minimum. The reason why the laws of tznius are stricter for women, you might say, than for men, is really because of a chisaron with men. That's really the point. The point is, all of the laws of tznius presuppose that men are creatures who get very easily aroused and do and think improper things and do improper things. So in a sense, women are the korbanos of the debasement of the male. So if anything, the laws of tznius are not designed to put women down, they are designed to put men down. And that's really what the laws of tznius are. A man, and there's a man not being properly dressed, is not going to have the same effect on a woman as a woman not being properly dressed.
Just a follow-up, two follow-ups. Collarbone for woman,
yeah.
And then is tznius, the way women dress, is that subjective or objective? Like if you were to go to Polynesia, and I mean, where you have like people running around,
yeah,
for all intents and purposes, half naked, and
yeah,
you've got your wife dressed, yeah, it kind of attracts attention. What's the...
Yeah, so let me let you mention a few things. Number one, the laws of tznius, well, collarbone is something that has to be, collar should be above the collarbone. That is true. But the thing is, tznius, hilchos tznius are a combination of subjective and objective, meaning to say, what I described are objective norms that halacha requires. And then if the community does more than that, a person should try to fit in. But if a woman is at home, you know, or in a place which doesn't follow that, she could be nakel. But objectively, there is a certain minimum. Now, let me point out two things about tznius. Number one, it is a little unfortunate that when we talk about tznius, we only think about dresses and length of dress and everything else. First of all, even in terms of its own narrow concern, that's inaccurate, because when people wear tight-fitting clothing and the like, even if everything is the right length, that is a tremendous pirtza in the laws of tznius. And that's a preliminary point, which even among very firm people, you sometimes have that as a serious problem. But more importantly, more and more fundamentally, tznius is not defined by dress. Tznius is defined by attitude. The attitude of tznius is that a person recognizes that their physical body is not what is important in the world. What is important is their mind, their character, their midos, and their avodas Hashem. And tznius is the idea that I'm not here to emphasize and glorify the physical. So really, dress is an outgrowth of attitude. So when we talk about tznius, both men and women need to focus that what is the ikar of life, what is the tachlis of life, and my dress is an expression of my panemius and not emphasizing chitzenius. That's an important idea. Now, let me mention another thing about hilchos tznius. Just, I think analytically, this is a very important thing to be aware of. If you learn Maseches Brachos, you're familiar with this a little bit. And that is, let's say if a woman is not tsanua, there are two different halachic concepts that have to be involved. Concept number one is, what is she allowed to dress as? What is she not allowed to dress as, right? That's in terms of her halacha walking in the street. There's another halacha that a man is not allowed to say divrei Torah, brachos, or kriya shema if he's looking in the direction of a woman that's not dressed properly tzniyistic. And that's a separate halacha. That's in Aruch Chaim. In other words, the intrinsic laws of tznius are in Evan HaEzer, and the prohibition of Devarim Shebikdusha is in Aruch Chaim and Hilchos Kriyashma. Now, that prohibition is only to say words of Torah or Bracha. It's not forbidden to think them. So if you're sitting in a bus and you're facing women that are dressed not tzinias, so you are allowed to think about Divrei Torah. And if you want to say a bracha or a davin or something like that, you have to either close your eyes or look in the sitter or optimally, you know, turn in a different direction. Now, that, there's a very big chiddush from the Aruch HaShulchan, because of this. According to the law of the Gemara, if a married woman's hair is uncovered, even if it's your own wife, you're not allowed to say Kriya Shema or say brachos in the presence of a woman whose hair is uncovered. On this, the Aruch HaShulchan paskins that if you live in a society where so many married women don't cover their hair, even though it is usur for them to do so, but you become habituated, so there's no longer a sexual distraction, you're allowed to say Devarim Shebikdusha. The Korban Nisanel says that even applies to the tzinias of above the arm and everything else. We don't go that far. But I want to point out that the heterum of habituation that you have Lagabi Kriyashma do not mean it's a heter for the woman herself. It just means if it's not so distracting, I'm allowed to daven. So you have to differentiate between the halachos of Kriyashma and Brachos versus the halachos of how the woman herself should dress. Yeah.
The Chumash mentions several instances of the forefathers digging wells. Now, the way that I'm familiar with the dig a well is using machines that are extremely heavy, and even then it takes hours to dig a hole, you know, through rock. Now, I'm assuming that the forefathers were on ground that was hard, like Israel was. I guess most of Israel is rock.
Right.
How exactly did they dig it?
Well, listen, I mean, this is hardly a kach on the Chumash, because obviously in the ancient world they had wells. I mean, you knew that before you read it in Bereishis, and there must have been a way. Well, how did Herod build the Western Wall, right? At the base of the Western Wall, you know, below the ground level today, you will see gigantic foundation rocks that are hundreds of tons, thousands of tons, really. And even with modern machinery, we actually don't have a way of moving it. You know, how did they do it? Well, if you're Herod, it's not so much of a question, because Herod will just use 10 million people to move it, and whatever it is. I mean, he has an unlimited population that will do whatever he tells them to do. Now, granted, I'm assuming that Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were not that way. They didn't have the same number of people that Herod controlled, and they probably weren't, well, they certainly were not as cruel as Herod was. But, you know, it depends, you know. Some wells, sometimes the soil is not rock. You know, you're not dealing with water that is trapped in rock. But the notion of, you know, breaking through rock was known in the ancient world. As soon as you have iron tools, you're able to go through rock. So I also don't know how big the wells were. It's hard for us to know. But I'll see if I can find out. You know, I'm not a geologist. I'm not an expert in well digging. But all I can tell you is this is hardly unique to the Torah. I mean, obviously, every desert culture needed wells, and they dug them somehow. Yeah.
Nowadays, current heads of state and leaders of other countries, would they still have the designation halakhically of kings and the like? Where those such halachas would still apply?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Someone that literally asked me this question. During Hanukkah, somebody who has a Jewish music group, and they were invited to sing in the White House for whatever Hanukkah concert or whatever. So he asked me whether he should recite the bracha that the Gemara in Bracha says when you see a king. The bracha is, Nasan mechachmasa. I'm sorry. I remember that. No, I was thinking that's bracha for the wise. There is a bracha for a king that you recite. So the Rishonim say, Lemaisa, that the definition of a melech for purposes of this bracha only applies to a melech that has the power of life and death. A king that can say, off with your head. A king that can just order you to be executed. So therefore, number one, democratically elected people do not have the status of a melech. Now, it's true that a president can pardon you if you were sentenced to death, but he doesn't have the power to condemn a person to death. And even monarchs like Queen Elizabeth, constitutional monarchs, we call them, don't have that power either. So, bizman hazeh, we don't make that bracha. What's a little odd to me is, It's an odd situation, because that implies when you meet a dictator, you know, you meet the guy head of Iran or something, you know, you're supposed to make a bracha, you know, you meet a good guy, a relatively good person, no bracha, right? I mean, so that's another shaila, whether the bracha was ever mesukin for Rishoyim, right? So that's a separate issue. What are you giving thanks to Hashem about some Russia? So Lagabe bracha, we would actually say that democratically elected people or even constitutional monarchs are not kings for purposes of that bracha, because the power of life and death is not directly in their hands. Now, the issue of whether somebody's a melech comes up in a lot of other questions as well. For example, we have in the Rambam Hilchos Melachim the power of a melech to go to war, etc., all of these different halachas. So here we do have a tshuva from Rav Kook. Rav Kook was the first chief rabbi of not the state of Israel, because he died before there was a state of Israel, but it was called Palestine then, or whatever. Rav Kook, as you probably have absorbed over the years, is a very controversial person. But the one thing that one should know is he was a great Gadol B'Torah. The reason why he is controversial is that out of his he was a great Mekubal also, but out of his Avos Yisrael, he interacted quite a lot with the secular Zionists and even anti-religious people, and he felt that they have a big zechus in the building up of Eretz Yisrael, and for that reason he was very, very criticized by other Gedolim who had a different shita. But he was Rabbi Yashiv's Masader Kedushin, and he was even Rabbi Yashiv Shatran. So he was a very, very great man. He was Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's Rebbe. So Rav Kook was very, very highly regarded by most Gedolim, although many Kanoim were against him. And today he's largely discredited in the yeshiva world and the Haredi world. But I would tell you that that's wrong, that is not a correct attitude to have. Now, but be it as it may, Rav Kook had the position, took the shita, that monarchy is only one form of government the Torah requires. And when you have either a Knesset or a president that collectively is exercising the authority of a king, then all the laws of Melech apply to that collective entity. So therefore, Rav Kook basically said that the status of Melech reverts to whatever body is given the governmental authority over the Jewish nation. So Rav Kook would actually say, putting aside the bracha issue, Rav Kook would actually say that the modern state of Israel will have the halacha of a Melech. Back to Hilchos Melachim.
In terms of passing down the tradition from Hashem to Moshe, how could it be that we now have a focus between Rashi and Rebbeinu Tam in terms of the order of the parshas?
Yeah, that's a very, very hard, very, very hard question. That particular example is one of the hardest questions, and I'll tell you why. People ask a general question about, hey, the oral law, the Torah Shel was given by Hashem to Moshe and passed down. Right? So how is it Shaykh Machlokas? How can you have an argument? One Mandirma says Kasher, one says Treif, one says Tameh, one says Torah, one says Chayav, one says Butcher. What did Hashem tell Moshe? And if Hashem told Moshe Chayav, then the guy that says Butcher got it wrong, and vice versa. How do you reconcile the notion of the divine origin of Torah Shebal Peh with the idea of Machlokas? In other words, we're saying two contradictory things. On one end, we say they're both right. Eilu v'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. Well, how can they both be right? Didn't Hashem say one or the other? So, as a general rule, and this is not your kasha is stronger than this, as a general rule, our answer is that most of the time, Hashem didn't give an answer to the question at all, meaning to say the following. Torah Shebal Peh consists of general principles. It does not consist of every single shaila that will come up. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe klalim and yesaides. It's then left to the chachamim to apply those klalim to particular cases. And when chachamim are taking the same klalim and applying those klalim to different cases, they will come up with different opinions. And Hashem basically says, as long as the chachamim are using what I gave Moshe Rabbeinu, both opinions are considered to be blessed by Hashem. So normally it's not a stira, because if the chachamim are debating about a particular thing, they're using the kolam of the Messiah. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, whatever they come up with, I accept. Even if it's not my answer. Lo b'shamayimi, meaning what they come up with is my rasa.
What is that in the Mishnah?
So I didn't hear you.
What is that
in the What are Mishnayos? Mishnayos were not given. Absolutely, it's a big, big mistake. Mishnayos were absolutely not given to Moshe B'Sinai. Mishnayos is a record of hundreds of years of machloksim between Tanoim in trying to interpret the Torah Shebal Peh that Rav Yehuda Hanasi wrote down because there was a danger of those Mishnayos being of those halachas rather being forgotten. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I'm just trying to picture. I'm trying to place everything in the clone that are given.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let me put it this way. If you're asking me, where can we find the exact nusach of the Torah Shebal Peh that Hashem gave to Moshe? The answer is we don't have the book. In other words, we can't say for sure, word for word, what Hashem gave Moshe. We know he gave him, for example, the 13 principles of interpretation. We know certain things are called halacha l'Moshe Misina, which is only a small part of Torah Shebal Peh, which are direct halachos that Hashem gave Moshe. And we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Moshe the basic explanations of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. And Chazal were makabel that generation after generation. But if you think about it, most machloksim are not about the basic definition of a mitzvah. But they are about details. For example, we have everybody's moda, a sukkah has to have three walls, and it has to have schach, and the schach has to be a dover that's not makabel tuma, and something that's talush. We have a machlokes, what if it's 20 amos high, more than 20 amos high. So what you're dealing with is, the chachamim have the basic information, and then they have to figure out applications. On that, there's going to be machlokas, right? On that, there's going to be machlokas. And Rav Yehuda Hanasi wrote down listings of all the basic machloksim of Torah in Torah Shebal Peh. In other words, Torah Shebal Peh has two components. There is the direct Torah Shebal Peh that was ish mi pi ish from Moshe Rabbeinu. But then there are all the additional interpretations of the Chachamim. Yud Gimel Midas, for example. The Yud Gimel Midas were given to Moshe B'Sinai. But the particular drushos that are made from the Yud Gimel Midos, the Chachamim did in every generation, using the Yud Gimel Midos. That's why one Mandi Amar makes a drusha, one Mandi Amar doesn't make a drusha, or makes the drusha differently. They're both using the same klolim, you see, but they use them in different ways. So the idea of how can there be machlokes in Torah Shebal Peh is not such a contradiction. Hashem gave the klolim, which were never distorted. And then we have machlokes on how to apply them. But the reason why tefillin is such a difficult question is the following. Tefillin is not like a case that came up, right? Cases come up, like what happens when Erev Pesach is Shabbos, do you bring the Korban Pesach? And the Chachamim have to figure that out. But tefillin is a mitzvah that is done every day except on Shabbos. Meaning from the time of Moshe, when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai, Jews started putting on tefillin. And there, it's inconceivable. It's not a shaila that comes up later for which the Chachamim have to paskin. Like some guy built the sukkah 25 amos for the first time, so we have to, we don't know what the halach is, we have to try to figure it out. Right? Many shailas just came up. And they're going to have to figure it out. Electricity, even today, when electricity was invented, is electricity usher on Shabbos? We have to figure it out. But how is it shayach by tefillin to figure it out? L'chara, they started with Moshe Rabbeinu, and they did it all the time. So at that point, somebody deviated from what, right? In other words, are we going to assume that from Moshe Rabbeinu's time there were two versions of tefillin? How could that be? What version did Moshe Rabbeinu say? And you can't even say, well, Moshe Rabbeinu said, here are two versions. Because that's not shaykh, because Rabbeinu Tam Shita is that Rashi's tefillin are pasul. It's not that. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have said, hey, here are two versions of tefillin, you can choose what you want. All right, that would be doable. But each one is saying the other one is pasul. It's no good. But even looking at it in terms of Rabbeinu Tam, you have a problem. I mean, did Rabbeinu Tam invent Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? I mean, Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson. Rabbeinu Tam lived in the 1200s, in the 1100s. So one day Rabbeinu Tam just gets up and says, all the tefillin in the world are puzzle. You are all doing it wrong. They do have a story. There's a little legend that when Rabbeinu Tam was a little baby, so Rashi had him on his lap, and Rashi wore tefillin all day. And the story goes, Rabbeinu Tam pulled off, the baby Rabbeinu Tam pulled off Rashi's tefillin from his head. You know, who knows if that's true. So number one, you have to understand that Rabbeinu Tam did not make up his thing, that indeed Rabbeinu Tam said there were old makoros that showed it somewhere. So at least we don't have Rabbeinu Tam inventing it. But still, the question is, how do you get a deviation on something that is done on a daily basis? I can understand machlokas on a new situation that arises in which we have to figure out how to apply the halacha. It's yitachin machlokas. But on tefillin, l'chayra, there would have been an unbroken messiah. I don't have a tremendously good answer. What was once suggested to me was that it's not so pashut that tefillin was normally a daily thing. That since tefillin has many, many halachos regarding a guf naki, a clean body, such as people who have digestive problems, and many halachos regarding kavana. Now, we're nako in kavana because we don't have such kavana anyway, but at a time when people were expected to reach a high level of kavana, if they did not have that level, they would not wear tefillin. So it turned out, as it were, that there may have been many, many Jews who did not wear tefillin, and as a result, in the course of time, there could have been uncertainties or differences. But that's very dochet, because still, I would still have to assume that most people wore tefillin. So your kasha is a good kasha. I don't have a very good mahalach as to the origin of the uncertainty regarding what is the proper order of tefillin. Whether, just to be sure people understand, the difference between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, externally they look virtually the same. The difference is in the tefillin shel rosh. Tefillin shel rosh, you have four parshiyos from the Torah. Shema v'hayam shemoa kadesh v'hayaki yiviyacha. And basically there's simply a machlokas of what order the parshiyos are put in, that's all. They're put in a different order. That may sound like a minor thing, but in reality, the placement of the parshios is ma'akev. A tefillin or puzzle if the parshios are not put in the right way. And therefore, Rashi's tefillin or puzzle like Rabbeinu Tam, and Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin or puzzle according to Rashi. By the way, although the Gra of Chaim Voloshiner wore tefillin all day, but the Gra was not nayeg to wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. And when the Chaim Voloshiner asked the Gra, why don't you wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? The Gra said, well, why should I wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? He says, well, it's a machlokas. Don't you want to be yaitse all of the opinions? So the Gra made a cheshbon. If I wanted to be yaitse every conceivable machlokas in tefillin, I would have to wear 64 pairs of tefillin. And the Gra enumerated all of the different machlokas and tefillin. So he says, so I can't wear 64 pairs of tefillin, so why should I go with two pairs? Now, as you know, the Shulchan Aruch actually paskins that a person that is midas chassidus, it doesn't mean a chassid, it means a pious person, a yarei shemayim, should be mishtadal to wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, and there is a machlokas how to wear it. A svardim that wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, they actually wear two pairs of tefillin at the same time. Have you ever seen that? Because the Gemara says they're small tefillin, that in the place of the head, you're able to have two pairs of tefillin, and the same thing on the hand, so they actually have two pairs of tefillin simultaneously. Sometimes it's side by side, and sometimes one is in back of the other. Among Hasidim, the minhag of Rabbeinu Tam is you wear Rashi for Kriya Shema and Shemona Esrei, and then after Shemona Esrei, you switch to Rabbeinu Tam for the end of davening. So there's a tshuva in the Ikras Moshe where the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked Rav Moshe why Rav Moshe doesn't wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. Of course, Rav Moshe is a Litvashe. He wouldn't wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. But he asked Rav Moshe, why don't you wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? So Rav Moshe said something. I'm not sure if it was an excuse or whatever. He said, well, he would have worn Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, but since Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin is only a heater, it's not a chiyuv, you should only do it if you have a sefer that you're 100% absolutely, positively guaranteed is going to be kosher. For Rashi's tefillin, we can't always demand 100% certainty because we got to wear tefillin. But Rav Moshe says, for Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, you have to have a 1,000% cipher, and we don't have that today. That's what Rav Moshe said. So the Rebbe said, I'll find you somebody. What if I find you? Somebody. That's you. So he found a cipher that Rav Moshe, you know, had to be makir, was 100%. So I'm not sure if Rav Moshe just felt he had to keep what he said, or if Moshe genuinely wanted. But Seif Yama from Moshe wore a Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, written by that cipher. Now, although the Gra says that there are 64 pairs of tefillin, no, but in truth, there is in fact a third set of tefillin that some people hold you should wear. And this is from the time of the Ga'inim, a Shimusha Rabba, it's called. So I know in Chabad, the minog is that Hasidim wear Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but Shimusha Rabba is only mutter for the Rebbe to wear. That one of the signs of the Rebbe, the Nasi of Chabad, is that he also wears Shimusha Rabba tefillin. And in Chabad chronologies, you always see that one of the signs that which son was designated as the future Rebbe, which son or son-in-law, as in the last case, is the one that the prior Rebbe gave the Shimusha Rabba tefillin. He didn't say, you're going to be Rebbe. He didn't use those words. But by giving the Shimusha Rabba tefillin, that was the sign of the Messias. Yeah.
The
Messias
starts with the
But like the Ramchal, it's actually not a contradiction, because Nachman, what does the Ramchal say? HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us because he wanted to give us pleasure, because he's a native, so he creates in order to give pleasure to his brewer. The philosophical conundrum, of course, that raises, I'm sure Rabbi Gottlieb will address that better than I, but you know, basically the problem basically means that implies before God created us, God has a need to be native. And without a Bria, there is a need within Hashem which is not being met. So philosophically that means Hashem was missing something. How is it Shaykh to say Hashem is missing something if Hashem is showing? Okay, I'm going to leave that question aside. I don't have an answer to that totally. But be it as it may, right, so that's point one. The tachlis of the Bria is because Hashem wants to be native. Okay, now. The question then becomes, if he wants to be native, so why don't I just get $1 million and unlimited ice cream sodas, whatever it would be? Why do I have to, you know, get up for slichas or whatever it is? So what does the Ramchal say then? So the second answer is, if he were to be native to us without us earning it, the hatava would not be complete because that would be called the bread of humiliation and shame. That's called Nahama de Kisufa, it's Aramaic, for the bread of shame. So we had to create a structure where we work and we struggle and we're kovesh, our Yetzer Hara, in order that when he eventually is native in Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh, it's something we earned and therefore we get the full satisfaction of earning it. So Mamela, it's not a stira. Hashem created us so that we shall give glory to him, but the purpose of the glory is that we earn the hatava that he gives us. In other words, the glory is the avaida we have in life, which in turn is for the ultimate purpose of Hashem being native. Right? So like the Ramchal, it actually is reconcilable in those two steps. By the way, just throughout another conundrum, you can ask Rabbi Gottlieb for something, because again, there's not such a good answer for this either. And that is, well, wait a second. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is infinite. Hashem can do anything. Well, so he has to give us all of these mitzvahs because otherwise we would be embarrassed by the Hatava. So let him create us without being embarrassed. You know? I mean, he made us get embarrassed when we get something for nothing. Right? So you're kind of saying, well, since Hashem made us that we get embarrassed when we get something for nothing, so we have to make it that we earn it. Okay, but if he wants to be native, right? So I just want to say, I think in some ways, those are unanswerable questions. In other words, in any aspect, you're going to reach a point in your Drisha V'Chakira where you're going to hit a wall. Because basically, we can only analyze decisions within the framework of the universe as we understand it. We cannot really posit why alternative universes were not made. For example, if I would ask you, well, why is there a rule of gravity where things that are dropped go down? Why didn't Hashem make the world where things that are dropped go up? We can't really answer. I mean, the Rambam himself says we can't really answer that question because being products of the universe, we have to ask if things make sense within the structure of the universe. Are they logical within the structure of reality that we're in? We can't automatically ask a question about an alternative structure. So the Ramchal's point is this. The reality of the world is when we get something for nothing, we feel ashamed. We're a bit humiliated. Given that reality, we now understand why within that framework Hashem has to give us mitzvahs. To ask a question, well, why couldn't we be created without that embarrassment, is already posing an alternative universe framework. And that already, the person within one universe cannot really understand, you know, what another universe would be. So, but it is a difficult question. At some point, you're always going to hit all of these difficult questions. Yeah.
What's the Jewish view on the origin of fossils, you know, dinosaur bones, so to speak, and other such ancient things?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different views, and it's actually a bit controversial right now within the Torah camp. There was a Rabbi Slifkin, who his books used to be in the library, maybe they took them out. You know, he used to teach in Osameach. He wrote all sorts of books about the age of the earth, and that, you know, you could be a religious Jew and believe the world is millions of years old, etc. And he had haskamas from Chashuv people, but then the books were put in Cheirim. Rabbi Gazi himself revised his website. If you could get a snapshot of his old website, you would see things that he Bedafka took out of his new website after all of this and the like. But I'll tell you this. I mean, basically, I think there's a relatively simple answer for age of the earth. There's a very simple answer. You don't have to be that sophisticated. Chazal simply... Oh, okay. Some people take the position that apparent age is simply a mirage to test your bechira, meaning to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu put things in the earth, or the world, that look old, but it doesn't mean they are old. In other words, the world was created old. Let's imagine you were Adam HaRishon on the sixth day of creation. Now, Adam HaRishon came into a world that had petroleum and that had coal. Now, if you would have had a carbon dating, the day of Adam Rishon's creation, you would have had a carbon dating of 5,000, of maybe millions of years, right? The answer is, Hashem put things in the world that already were old, right? So that's one idea. The world was created old. Just like cows were created fully grown, and redwood trees, right? California redwood trees were created in the Shesha Shemei Bereshis. Now, you would have seen tree rings that say they're, 1,000 years old, right? So that's one mahalach. But another mahalach to fossils and the like is simply this. Chazal say that before this world, Hashem created other worlds that he destroyed. That's a chazal. Now, you don't have to learn other worlds that he destroyed refers to planets out there. Maybe other worlds that he destroyed refers to this very earth that got progressively destroyed. And destroyed doesn't mean it blew up and was nothing. But destroyed could have meant ice ages. It could have meant earthquakes. It could have meant meteorite showers and the like. So when we say that the world is only 5,774 years old, we are referring to that which is described in Chumash Bereishis. But Chazal say there was Borei Olamo Sumachriban. So the fossils and the dinosaurs could very well be remnants of those pre-existing worlds, based on Chazal's teaching that there were prior worlds. Now, you'll notice what I'm not saying here. I'm not making the argument, although I can make that argument too. I'm not making the argument that the 6 days of creation are more than 24 hours long, because I'm not making the argument how long the 6 days of creation are. We can talk to say the 6 days of creation are 24 hours long, but I'm simply locating the dinosaurs in the pre-existing worlds that are subsumed under Chazal's statement of Borei Olamais Umachriman. I think that really is a relatively simple answer. Now, when you get into the other discussion about how long are the 6 days, that's also an approach that one could take, because the sun was not created until day four, right? And Mimela, for the first 3 days, you didn't have the 24-hour cycle of sunrise, sunset, and the like. But that already gets us into the dangers of the very first question of taking things in the Torah and disregarding their literal meaning. That already moves you into a more questionable area. But if you look at the dinosaurs as the pre-worlds that Chazal say did exist, so I don't see any really problem with that at all. Now, there are more complicated answers if you're a physicist. For example, Dr. Gerald Schroeder has this idea that time could be measured in two ways under the theory of relativity. Something can be 5,000 years and at the same time be a billion years. Those are already sophisticated, difficult issues, that time can be measured in two different ways depending on the standpoint of the observer. Okay, yeah, that's yet another approach. But I think what I said is actually very, very simple, and it doesn't get you into a lot of theological problems. Yeah.
What's the problem with drawing pictures of the others?
There is no problem per se. There is no issue of drawing a picture of the others, but I think the minhag has been not to do those things. Although not everybody keeps that minhag. And part of it is that when you kind of make people look like you, so to speak, so maybe psychologically on some level we bring them down to our level, and it was thought perhaps it would take away some of the sense of the kedusha that they had. Just as Moshe Rabbeinu's face was covered because he was davar b'shechina, so there's a notion that we try not to picture. By the way, there used to be an idea, havdol, many, many, infinite havdolas, even in TV shows. This is a long time ago, a real long time ago, when you were allowed to watch TV. But we had a terem in those days. But the thing was, they used to not show the president. I don't mean a news conference, but if the president of the United States was, an actor in a movie, that wouldn't show his face. And I remember hearing this, although it may not have been true, that somebody said, "Well, it's not respectful for somebody to portray the president. You don't show." So it's an amazing thing. So even the Goyim had this sense that you don't show the person's face. He's not one of us. He's above us. That wasn't even true. But okay. But I think that's part of the idea. But for mice, I wouldn't be overly machmer. I mean, a lot of kids' plays, they'll dress up a kid as Avram or whatever it is. But that's the basis of it. Yeah.
Could you speak a little about Phil and regards to driving and also talking?
Yeah. Yeah, they used to say in the name of the stipler, but I don't think he said it halacha l'maisa, that even a local trip in Yerushalayim requires tefillah sederet, because the idea that the roads are sakana applies very much to local driving in Israel. But tefillah sederet, is a chiyuv when you leave a city and you're on an open highway. Now, exactly how that applies, even in America, is not always clear because you have continuous cities one after the other. So generally speaking, in the United States, you only recite Tefillah Sederech when you are on what you call an interstate highway, like 95, if you're familiar with that, and the like. In Eretz Yisrael, it's a
time minimum.
Huh?
Meaning, let's say you live via interstate highway and you're only going 2 hours.
Generally speaking, number one, you have to be going to another city. In other words, if you use the interstate just to move within the same city, you would not. The time limit, generally speaking, based on different computations, it has to be a trip of at least a half an hour. And that covers you for the whole day. It covers the return trip as well. Now, you would say Tefillah Sederech if you're going to Beit Shemesh, right? A lot of people don't do that, but actually you would say Tefillah Sederech there to Tel Aviv. All of that would have a Tefillah Sederech. If you're driving within a city, you do not say Tefillah Sederech country, in spite of the stipler's remark, even if you used Kvish Echad, you want to go to Ramat Eshkol, right? So technically, you could be using Highway 1, but since that's an intra-city trip, there's no Tefillah Sederech. For an airplane, You, of course, have to say Tefillas HaDerech, but you can say it in the car to the airport, and that will cover the airline trip. The big problem with a plane, the big shiloh of the plane, is not Tefillas HaDerech. That for sure you have to say, but Birchas HaGomel. Now, that's a separate thing. Birchas HaGomel is a bracha that you make, according to the Gemara in Brachos, when you've been through some dangerous situations. And you have to thank Hashem that even though I'm deserving of punishment, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu did good for me to protect me from a danger. Now, the Gemara says there are four sakanos, four, that you bench Gomel for. It mentions four specific things. It mentions people who are wandering through a desert, Midbar. It mentions sick people who recovered from their sickness. It mentions people in prison, right? You're released from a prison. And it mentions people who were traveling on the ocean. Okay, so it's ocean travelers, prisoners, sick, and people who were wandering in the desert. Now, an airplane, quite literally, that's the question. The question is, an airplane is not any of those four. So some posts can say, well, since it flies over water, that's called a sea voyage. And according to those poskim, they would be mechalek between a flight that is over water, such as a transit, you know, going to America, versus a domestic flight, like going from New York to Los Angeles. Others say that really doesn't make sense, because if air flight is considered to be dangerous, and that's a question too, then if anything, actually a pilot will tell you, I don't want to scare anybody, because I happen to be a nervous flyer myself, but they will tell you that a flight over water is safer than a flight over land. It is easier, actually, to have an emergency landing, because it can float, whatever it is. If it's land, and God forbid, the plane crashes, it's a little more difficult to, whatever, that's what they tell you. Okay, be it as it may. So there are actually three opinions about how Birchas HaGomel for an airplane. Some say you only make Birchas HaGomel if it goes over sea. And in this connection, by the way, lakes and rivers do not count. It has to be the sea. Opinion number two says all airplane trips, even over land, require Gomel. Now, that could be quite strict, because that could mean you just go from New York to Chicago, you bench Gomel. We don't really pass him that way. And there is a third sheet that actually says you do not make Birchas HaGomel on airplane at all, because they claim, number one, airplanes are not sea voyages, and number two, air traffic is actually safer than driving. So they say, what's the logic here? And that happens to be true. The likelihood of, God forbid, being killed in an automobile accident is greater than the likelihood of dying in an airplane accident. I mean, the reason airplanes scare us is because when accidents happen, they involve large numbers of people. But in terms of the numbers of miles, passenger miles traveled, airplanes are relatively safe. So there are three different shitas about that. The halacha tends to follow the middle shita, that if the airplane went over ocean water, you make Birchas HaGomel. Okay. Now, those are the four categories. But then, there's another halacha, that if a person was actually in a dangerous situation of any kind, even if it didn't fit one of those four, for example, you were in an accident, etc., you bench a Gomel. But here, there are many, many ways of interpreting that. In Eretz Yisrael, maybe because people are tougher, they tend to be very limited in when they bench Gomel. I'll give you an actual case. Let's say you're sitting on a bus and the seat in back of you is empty, is vacant, and the bus does not have bulletproof windows, and you're driving around Hebron, and a 50-pound rock comes crashing through the window right in back of you. If it would have hit you, you would be a goner. But Baruch Hashem, it didn't hit you, it just crashed through the window in back of you. Do you bench Gomel for such an occurrence? Many Rabbanim in America would say, of course you do. But the psak I heard here was, well, It didn't hit your row. It was the row behind you. So you really were not in danger. So they kind of say it has to, like, go right by you, so to speak. So there you have to ask a shayla. In each of these cases, you have to ask a shayla about gaimel for near actions. Now, if, God forbid, a person was hospitalized, that would have fallen within the category of cholish and israpa. But if it missed you, in a lot of the cases of accidental near misses, actually, near misses is a funny English phrase. Why do we call it near misses? It's a near hit. It's interesting. The whole phrase near miss is a nonsensical English expression. But whatever it is. If it's a near miss, the minhag in Eretz Yisrael is not to bench gaimel for these things. The minhag in America is people do bench gaimel for near misses that could have been fatal. In Eretz Yisrael, a near miss is not considered to be enough of an accident. That is mechayev birchas hagaimel. Another very relevant shayla is, which is not negated to you guys yet, is does a husband bench gaimel for his wife? Does a parent bench gaimel for a child? Let's say a child was b'sakana, or a woman was b'sakana. So ideally, a husband should not bench for his wife. Ideally, the woman should bench herself, and she needs a minion, and either the minion goes to her house, or during a Shabbos Kiddush, she would bench gaimel. And by the same token, ideally, nobody makes the bracha for a child, because a katan himself does not bench gaimel, and the parents are not mechuyev to bench gaimel for a child. But nevertheless, you will find some poskim that do say husband can make for wife, and they will say that parent can make for a child. But the one thing is absolutely true, according to all opinions, the child does not bench gaimel for a very simple reason. The nusach of birchas hagaimel is that Hashem did a chesed for somebody who was deserving of punishment. So it might be a parent could make that bracha, because a parent is sometimes responsible for what happens to a child, but the child is under no definition a guilty party, and therefore the child cannot make birchas hagaimel, even mitam chinuch. Yeah.
So it seems like in Chazal and other svarim, that the emotions are placed in the heart, whereas today in science it seems like most of the emotions are in the mind.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, you get into the problems of the anatomical descriptions of parts of the body, what they do, don't fit the scientific understanding. Heart, we say seat of emotion, seat of feeling, even though we think it's the brain. Kidneys are described in Chazal as a great source of wisdom, although a scientist will not talk about any mental cognitive function that is in the kidneys itself. The liver is said to be the seat of sexual desire, although as far as we know, the liver is not connected to that particular function, and the like. So there are different answers to that. You know, one answer would be, and here already we get back to the non-literal, that Chazal were using descriptions that were the science of the time, and Chazal did not mean to say this was a chelik of Torah. In other words, if you look at Greek medicine, look at Hippocrates, and look at Galen, you know, this is what they said. So Chazal were using the science of the time to talk about what they're talking about. So when they talk about emotion, they meant the heart, but they loved Dafka, you know, meant that the heart is the seat of emotion. That's one approach. The other approach that Mekubalim take is that indeed these things have these functions, even if they cannot be scientifically identified, meaning to say that the heart is a spiritual source of ruchnius, even if we perceive our emotions via the brain. All that would mean is that the heart spiritually sends messages to the brain, meaning to say, once you understand it as a realm of Kabbalah, it doesn't have to be anything that is visually or, you know, intellectually identifiable. These are spiritual kochos that then may operate on different parts of the body. And, you know, again, you can neither prove that nor disprove that. But all I'm saying is, it is a possibility that Chazal's descriptions are 100% literal on a ruchniistic level. Yeah.
What responsibilities does the Jewish view say that Jews and non-Jews have regarding protecting endangered species, such as polar bears and...
Yeah, well, you know, again, I think generally protection of the environment is a very chashuv thing. For example, the Ramban writes that there's a prohibition to create new species. Right? So they're interbreeding. You're not allowed to create a mule. You can't mate a horse and a donkey. That's an issue of the Arisa. You can ride a mule, and you can eat a hybrid fruit. You're allowed to eat it, but you're not allowed to make these things. And the Ramban says, because by changing the species that Hashem put into the world, you're kind of acknowledging or trying to make a statement that God's world is not perfect. So there is a concept that everything Hashem made has a positive purpose. Do you know the famous Medrash by David HaMelech? David HaMelech didn't understand why God created spiders. So spiders, so ugly and annoying, poisonous, black widow spider. So what happened? When David is running away from Shaul, he's hiding in a cave. And Shaul is going cave by cave by cave looking for David. And a spider came and wove a web in that cave, which normally takes a long time. So Shaul HaMelech passes by the spider and sees, passes by the cave and sees there's a spider web. So he says, David couldn't have been in here, right? So the spider saved David's life. He realized everything has a purpose. And the truth of the matter is, spiders have a tremendous purpose. They do a lot of things. They kill a lot of insects that would otherwise destroy crops. We're not even makir. You change one little thing in Hashem's Bria, and there's all sorts of consequences. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made things so perfect and so exact. You change something. You know, you could have floods or destruction. You never know what's going to happen. So the concept that Hashem's Bria is a good Bria, and everything Hashem made has a tachlis, would seem to indicate that it is part of our responsibility to preserve what Hashem created, because otherwise the purpose that Hashem had in creating it would not be realized. In other words, there must be a purpose for the polar bear, even though I don't know what it is exactly. They're cute, but dangerous, as it were. But there is a purpose. There has to be a purpose. Hashem wouldn't have made it. Eibazai, how can I allow something that has a purpose in Hashem's Bria to go away? Now, if you're asking me what the responsibility of a Jew is, you know, do I have to go to Alaska to take care of the seals or the polar bears and the like? You know, like everything else in life, you know, there are many things that the world needs. The question becomes, what should be my priorities? I cannot do every single thing that is needed for the world to be in a state of shlemus. So I have to do what I'm able to do. So certainly I wouldn't say that, you know, if you're looking at, you know, how should I spend the rest of my life, I wouldn't say preserving the polar bear should be the number one priority that you have. It is an important thing, and people who are interested in it, you know, should be encouraged to pursue it. But as I say, a lot of things in this world we have to leave to other people because we're more limited. I mean, I'll give you another example that's maybe even more important. Goyim are supposed to keep the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. The Rambam writes that Jews have a responsibility not to convert Goyim. We don't convert Goyim. But a responsibility to teach Goyim the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. So the question should become, should I go out, you know, in the street, go to non-Jewish neighborhoods and talk about the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach? Well, in theory I should, but you know, maybe I'll do that when every single Jew is keeping the 613, including me, is keeping the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. In other words, it's a question of priority. So I would consider it more of a priority problem, but I would acknowledge that there is a makom that this could be an important activity. Yeah. Well, you have to be a little more specific.
So we're doing I'm not going to share this morning told us that Hassan Sofer said that in Pesukim in the Vian, the Derisa, unless it's explicit.
Well, let me put it this way. I'll just quote. I mean, I'm not familiar with Hassan Sofer. I'd like to see it inside. The Rambam says in the Sefer HaMitzvos, the first Sherish of Sefer HaMitzvos, that the only thing that is Derisa is that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe at Har Sinai. And the interpretations the Chachamim have of what Hashem, in other words, if Hashem gave Moshe a mitzvah, and the Chachamim interpreted with the Yud Gimel Midos, that also becomes a Doraisa. But anything in Tanakh, outside of the five books of Moses, even if it's in the Nevi'im, is technically considered to be a Drabbanan. What the Nevi'im talk about, unless they're interpreting the Torah itself, is Drabbanan. That's why Megillas Esther, right? Megillas Esther, Purim, is a chag that is in the Tanakh, Megillas Esther. But the Mikra Megillah is treated as a Drabbanan. Now, it's true. You may ask the Kasha, so how come before I read Megillah, I make the Bracha, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav, God commanded me? But think about this. How many Drabbanan mitzvahs do I do that for? Netilah Shadayim is Drabbanan. Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav. Ner Chanukah is Drabbanan. It's post-biblical. Kriyas HaTorah is Midrabbanan, actually. Reading the Drabbanan, right? So the Rambam says, one of the mitzvahs of the Torah is to listen to the Chachamim. So every time you do a Drabbanan, you are fulfilling a Daraisa. So in that way, it's possible to say, depending on your, every Drabbanan is Daraisa. But the Rambam explains, to say that there's a general commandment to listen to the Chachamim is not the same thing as saying every specific Drabbanan is Daraisa. Right? So, it's correct that the Torah obligates me to listen to what the Chachamim said, but that's not the same as saying lighting Hanukkah candles is a mitzvah d'oraisa. Do you see the difference? So I'd like to see where the Chassam Sofer is, yeah, but the Pachas, it's not d'oraisa. Yeah.
What's the halacha on tipping waiters?
I mean, is it usher to tip a waiter?
No, is there a chiyuv to tip waiters?
I don't see any makom that there could be a chiyuv to tip a waiter.
What? The minhag is in the places.
Yeah, I don't think the minhag is machayev. The minhag is not machayev because tipping is not required. But I think it is important to tip a waiter. I know that single yeshiva students. I don't go to restaurants anyway. I said, but don't always have the money. But the truth is, waiters make very little money because the whole idea is the employer is so mech on tips coming in. And I want to emphasize, particularly if you're a firm person, not to tip a waiter is a very, very, very big chilul Hashem, because the last thing you need to do, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, where there's so much animosity between chilonim and religious people, is to have the idea that, oh, these religious Jews don't tip when every average person does. So it might very well be that the Kiddush Hashem Shebedov or the Chilul Hashem might make it a chiyuv for that. But I don't think it's a minhag that's b'chayev. Yeah.
Was Gan Eden a physical place between four rivers, or is it a metaphysical idea?
Yeah, well, we're back to that old problem. It's an amazing thing. I mean, Gan Eden is described geographically as between four rivers. And that doesn't seem to correspond with Eretz Yisrael. So the Gan Eden, as you got, and that's a very modern thing, that this ideal, perfect world was not Eretz Yisrael. I mean, that's a very, very strange idea. The Rambam says that Gan Eden was a physical place. Now, it may not exist anymore. In other words, it may be the meaning of Hashem closing it off by an angel might actually mean it was taken from the world. So there's not going to be this place you can find if you kind of wander around. You'll find yourself in Gan Eden. But apparently it did have an actual physical earthly existence. Did you want to say something?
I was wondering what the origin of Simchang with Shangmer was, and why in our new South we switch words that are not supposed to just say which part of Simchang.
Yeah. The rule is the following. First of all, what happens in Nusach HaTefillah is a very interesting thing. You often have machloksim between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, which you say, and then the Gaonim came to a compromise. One gets Shacharis and one gets Mincha and Ma'ariv. Sim Shalom and Shalom Rav started off that way as well. These were actually two different nuschais, that some people said Shalom Rav all the time, and some people said Sim Shalom all the time. The Gaonim were machriya. Now the basis of the hachra is the following idea, that you say Sim Shalom whenever you have Birchas Kohanim. Why is that so? Because Birchas Kohanim ends with the phrase, V'yasem l'cha shalom. May Hashem place peace on you. That is exactly the word Sim Shalom. Now, even though in Chutz La'aretz we don't, except for Sfarim, Ashkenazim do not duchen, except on Yom Tov, but since we do say Elokeinu v'Elokeinu b'Chayinu b'Bracha, so that's considered to be a Zman of Duchening. Now, so let me explain two minhagim. So when do we Duchen? As you know, we Duchen, or we say Elokeinu v'Elokeinu b'Seinu, only Shacharis. We don't Duchen at night, And we also don't duchen at mincha, normally. Why don't we duchen at mincha? Now, we don't duchen at night because birchas kayanim is compared to the avodah of the Beis HaMikdash that's not done at night. But why don't we duchen at mincha? So the Gemara says this is a gezeirah d'rabbanan not to duchen at mincha, because by mincha people already had their afternoon meal. The kohen might be drunk. A kohen that drank wine is not allowed to duchen. So because of this, Chazal abrogated the idea of duchening at mincha. There is a discussion in the Gemara. What about on a tainus? Do you duchen at mincha? Right. So there's a shaila about that. Now here's the thing. So that is why the standard minhag of Ashkenazim is that we only say Sim Shalom Shachris. We don't say Sim Shalom for Mincha and for Ma'ariv. We have the alternative bracha of Shalom Rav. Now, on a Tainus, you'll remember, we do say Sim Shalom at Mincha. Right? That's one thing you say it at Mincha. Why is that so? Because since on a Tainus nobody's eating, in theory, it would be a Zman of Duchening, even though we don't Duchen. But nevertheless, since potentially it's Roy for Duchening, that elevates us to Sim Shalom, and we do say Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu Borcheinu Bavracha. Okay. Now, the remaining thing is a peculiarity of the Minhag of Yerushalayim, and that is, there's one other time that the Minhag Yerushalayim is to say Sim Shalom even at Mincha. Anybody knows what that is? Shabbos Mincha. Shabbos Mincha, the Minhag is, some people just daven Ashkenaz, but the minhag Yerushalayim is to say Sim Shalom Shabbos Mincha. The reason for that is that even though we don't duchen and we don't say Lokei Lokei Avoseinu, we don't say that, but we do have Kriyas HaTorah, and since Torah is also considered to be a source of Hashem bringing Shalom to Am Yisrael, so when there's a Kriyas HaTorah, I misspoke. The reason why Sim Shalom is appropriate is because the longer bracha of Sim Shalom talks about the blessing of the Torah. Ki v'or panecha nasata lanu Hashem Elokeinu toras chayim v'yavas chesed. So when there's a kriya satayra, the minhag Yerushalayim, not because of duchening, the minhag Yerushalayim is to go to Sim Shalom. So that's kind of the basis of it. Yeah. Yep. So it really depends on the sefer. Now, Rebecca Kamenetsky once said a nice remark. You know, the Vilna Gaon writes, every word of Torah that you learn, you get like many, many mitzvahs. So Yaakov said it's a bit of a joke. You know, sometimes you have svarim that are so long-winded that they go on and on. I mean, why should you get reward because somebody it's not so much of a kacha, but because somebody says something in 10,000 words that he could have said in 5 words. You know, so Yaakov said, you're right. He says, you don't get reward for those types of svarim, but there are some svarim where every word has so much meaning that indeed you get reward. So you have to know what sefer it is. You don't always know, but there are certain svarim that are makubal in the Torah world, that they were written with extraordinary precision, and every diuk is appropriate. We have a Kabbalah. One of them happens to be the Mesilas Yesharim. It is said the Vilna Gaon, who lived after the Ramchal, the Vilna Gaon was obviously a phenomenal genius who knew absolutely everything, b'chala Torah kula. We can't even be Meshayer what the Vilna Gaon knew. And not just his brilliance, but his hasmada, right? Imagine what a combination this is. I mean, anybody who would learn as much as the Vilna Gaon would become a great, great gadol hador, even if you were not a genius. And with his genius, he could have been a gadol hador without even learning that much. I mean, the combination of the unbelievable hours, plus his sitkus and Yiras Shamayim, which is actually the more important one even, but the hours and the genius and the Yiras Shamayim together. And yet, the Vilna Gaon said, if the Ramchal would have been alive, he would walk barefoot to Amsterdam to learn from the Ramchal. And the Gra was made that in the first 11 chapters of Mesilas Yesharim, there is not an extra letter. There is not an extra letter. Now, people want to know, well, what is there something in chapter 12 that's extra? I wish I remember. Somebody came up with a cheshbon that there was something in Perek Yud Beis that the Ramchal didn't have to say. Okay, I don't remember what it is. But the Mesilas Yesharim is mekubal among Klal Yisrael, that is a sefer to be medayik. Mishnah Brewer is considered to be another sefer in Halacha, to be medayik. Chavitz Chaim wrote with extraordinary precision and daikonis. But, you know, if you're asking me every sefer, I can't tell you every sefer. Some svarim are not written with that same type of level. But there are svarim after the Gemara that are mekubal in that way. But derech klal, almost all the svarim of the Rishonim are written with extreme exactitude. The Achronim, to some degree, less so. Yeah.
What is the origin and meaning of Peis?
Well, the translation of Peis is corners, and this is based on the Torah. The Torah has a law that says, Lo sakifu, do not round out Paas Roshim, the corner of your head, right? So you have to have the teis kind of coming down. The Rambam gives the simplest explanation, but it's not so satisfying. The Rambam simply says that it was the minhag of the idolatrous priests that they would shave their sideburns. If you ever saw a picture of the old friars in England, Friar Tuck, remember Robin Hood? So they kind of have a circle around their head. They would like shave in a circular way. This is the way of the Avodah Zorah behaved. So the Rambam learns cutting payas was simply a harchaka from the minhagim of Avodah Zorah. Now again, it's not such a satisfying reason because Lamaisa today, you know, we don't have these idolatrous cultures, and what would the permanent relationship be? But on a more deeper level, part of the notion of the payas and the beard, which is a hamshacha of the payas, is to be mechaber, the seichel of a person, to the kayach of dibor, right? What is it? The payas connects the mouth and the brain, and the mouth in turn is then connected, right? The neck is then connected to the shoulders and the arm. So essentially, what's being indicated here is that a person's dibor and a person's maisa should come from the seichel. It shouldn't be instinct, it shouldn't be raw emotion, but everything comes from the seichel. The payas are mechaber. Right, so it's connected to that idea. And then Kabbalah is the whole point of the beard being a conduit of wisdom from the mind to the body. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question to the polar bear one.
Yes.
We're not supposed to change the environment or change the creation, and that is learned out from Ramban's prohibiting.
Yeah, the Ramban says that the prohibition of grafting and animal breeding, interspecies breeding, is we're not supposed to change creation. Now,
the umbilical cord, that's not even committed. Bruce is committed, so I can understand that. But yeah, cutting the umbilical cord, that's changing creation.
Well, your suggestion is that that the baby should remain permanently attached to the mother. I mean, some mothers would like that, but well.
It breaks on its own, right? I mean,
it does break on its own. The Maral actually says. That obviously the Torah does not mean we can't change nature in some way, because, for example, we can drain a swamp, right? We can combat disease. We can try to eradicate smallpox and polio, right? Why don't I say, oh, Hashem put smallpox into the world, you know, there must be a purpose for it. Obviously, in things like the mandate to heal, rapo yirapo, Hashem is giving us a certain koach. And even in Adam Rishon and Gan Eden, Liavda, he was given the power to work and cultivate, which implies a certain ability to manipulate nature. So the Maral actually says that the Ramban is broader than is in fact the case, that we do have a certain koach to manipulate nature, to change nature. Hashem made us with that koach. But nevertheless, the Torah is telling me, with respect to species, we need to understand that species have a role. So maybe I was going further than we actually say, but there is a notion that ki tov, that on these species there is a positive benefit that we can't perceive.
Is there a reason to think that Hashem will cause some species to go extinct for a reason there's nothing we can do to stop it?
Oh, for sure. Do you realize that every day there are like 1,000 species that die out? And these are mainly little insects. That this is a remark attributed to Darwin. I shouldn't quote Darwin as an authority. Darwin was actually a religious, I mean, he was a believing Christian. He believed in God, in spite of his evolution theory. He did not consider it a contradiction. But they once asked Darwin, you know, you've been such a student of nature for so many years. What has nature taught you about God? So Darwin said, well, the one thing I've learned is the Creator has a great fondness for beetles. Because there are literally tens of thousands of species, beetle species. And a lot of them just disappear. Now, if you ask me, so what is the tachlis of these, like, beetles located in Indonesia that, you know, one day they're here and one day they're gone? I have no idea, but we have to believe there is some tachlis. Now, remember, the Gemara says, by Malachi Asheres, there are some malachim that only get to praise Hashem every 10,000 years. And they wait for 10,000 years. They praise Hashem for a second. And then they disappear. What was their tachlis? Their tachlis for 10,000 years was that 1 second. Right? The Rambam says there might be a tree on a desert island, a redwood or something, that's been there for 1,000 years, and the only purpose of that tree is that one time there'll be a Talmud Chacham who momentarily gets shade under that tree. So why did Hashem have to do it 1,000 years earlier? Why couldn't he just do it right before? We don't know. But the assumption is things have tachlesen, and sometimes when their tachles is mekoyim, Hashem may take them away. But we're not supposed to deliberately accelerate that process.
So if species do go extinct beyond our control,
yep,
and they're destined to go extinct,
yep,
how can we say that man has any fear whatsoever to try to save them from going extinct? If they're destined to go extinct, what can we do?
Well, I guess it's the same idea of hishtaglus, meaning to say the following. When we're confronted with a situation that b'derech hateva we seem to have some control over, generally HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes his hands off the wheel, meaning to say, somebody's sick. Right? So you can make the argument, oh, somebody's sick, so why should he go to a doctor? Why should he have surgery? Why should he go to a hospital? If Hashem wants him to die, he's going to die no matter what I do. If Hashem doesn't want him to die, he's going to live no matter what I do. I mean, that's an argument. Why doubt it, right? That's the old argument. But basically, the way Hashem set up the world, and this is the realm of free will, and that is Hashem allocated a certain amount of authority to us in which what Hashem decrees is a function of how we behave and interact. So if you work, so good, all your money comes from God. But Hashem will say, if you work, you'll get it. If you don't work, you won't get it. In other words, Hashem will condition his beneficence on what you decide to do. Same thing with sickness. All refuah comes from Hashem. You will not get better unless it's Hashem's will. But Hashem created a world where sometimes, whether you'll get better or not depends on whether you utilize the shtadlus. So species determination or species termination is kind of the same thing. That if it's something that b'derech hateva is within our hands, then that would be a responsibility we're given, and then Hashem's decision will be connected to how we behave b'derech hateva. Things that are beyond our control are directly mediated by God. That's true. Okay, so that goes back to the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's gezeros are often based on what he has given us the authority to do. Once we are given the ability to do something, Hashem's gezero will be conditioned on the exercise of that ability. Okay? Any other questions running out? Okay, anyway, thank you. And,